Day Street Books and Harper Audio present The Office BFFs.
Tales of the Office from Two Best Friends Who Were There.
Written and read by Jenna Fisher.
And Angela Kenzie.
What are we doing? I thought we had to talk fancy.
I think maybe we're just supposed to talk like ourselves.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm very sure.
Oh, okay, fine.
Hi, you guys! We are so excited to read our book to you.
And we have some fun folks who will be popping in as well.
Starting off with Creed Bratton.
As you probably know, Creed is a wonderful musician, and we asked if he would write us a song for our audiobook.
Hit it, Creed!
Here's a tall tale, you could call it a yarn, about the office ladies and the show they spawned. They took our story and wrote it all down. Little Angela and her friend Pom, Jenna and Ange, Pumpkin and Pam, go together like eggs and spam. Their book's real cute, Rudy Toot Toot, Jenna and Ange, and which one's Pam?
I loved it.
It was the perfect way to start.
Really was.
Now for another special treat, written and read exclusively for the audiobook, a foreword by one of our favorite tall fellas, Rainn Wilson.
We asked Rainn to write this foreword because, from the beginning, our friendship has annoyed Rainn a great deal. This is mostly because our friendship involved a lot of early morning chatting, in the hair and makeup trailers and first thing on set. Rainn found this grating.
All true. However, Rainn is also one of our dearest friends, and most supportive, and we were very curious what he might say when asked to reflect on our best friendship. He warned us his foreword was, quote, a little bit edgy. So buckle in, folks. Here's Rainn Wilson.
Office Ladies Foreword. When Jenna and Angela begged me, tears streaming down their telegenic faces, to write a foreword for their book, I realized there was a tremendous challenge that lay before me, a challenge unlike any I had ever faced before. The Office Ladies podcast has generated a legion of rabid fans, and for good reason. Their adoration for the chirpy, genial hosts, the aforementioned Fisher and Kinsey, is awesome, inspiring, and truth be told, just a little bit weird. This puts me, Rainn Wilson, in a bit of a pickle. And I'm not talking about Pam's Pickles, the failed pickle company Jenna launched in 2009, which ended in scandal and a suspicious warehouse fire. You see, I adore these two office ladies. They're like the sisters I never had. Jenna and Angela are rays of light, beaming forth positivity, humor, and many apologies for the tired, sexist, and dated early 2000s reference, a kind of middle-aged mom, cougar-like sexuality that can, frankly, be overwhelming at times. We're talking straight-up cougar town. And I don't mean the failed Courtney Cox sitcom that ended in scandal and a suspicious warehouse fire. But my fear, my very real fear, is that if I tell the truth about them, if I speak my truth about these besties, their fan base will recoil, seethe, and yes, eventually lash out, both online and in person. If I choose to speak out what I know to be true, I fear for my literal life and my figurative one. So I will not. I have zero desire to get canceled over revealing the grotesque underbelly of this, for lack of a better word, friend cast, or pod ship, or book pod, friend book, podcast, ship, book, whatever you call it. I don't know. Doesn't matter. So for my safety, I will begrudgingly toe the official Office Ladies party line. Here goes. The Office Ladies podcast is so funny. The hosts are so delightful. The insight and humor they provide is essential for any office fan. In listening to their episodes, not only have I gleaned information about the show I participated in for 10 years, I learn episode by episode a little eensy teensy bit about myself, about my very soul. So when they showed me their book, The Office BFFs, I was intrigued. I thought, what more do these two have to say? As it turns out, a lot. These MILFs have triumphed once again. Stories of their friendship are mixed with in-depth analysis of our beloved TV show, the likes of which have never been heard before. Their tales of red carpet fiascos, pumping breast milk in their trailers, and their somewhat tedious recounting of every single holiday we ever celebrated as a cast will leave you feeling rejuvenated and inspired. This is a great book to keep by your toilet. Their prose is annoyingly charming, chipper, and chews away at any cynicism you might have. Seriously, after I read it, I gave myself a hug. Cue record scratch sound cue. I don't know how to make that sound cue. Oh, no, stop. Oh, I can't take it anymore. I simply cannot continue with this torrent of lies. Office ladies, they're no ladies. Office BFFs, they barely know each other. This book, it's filled with crap that never happened. These grotesque succubi have ruined more than enough lives, and it's time for them to get exposed once and for all. That's what she said. Number one, Angela owes me $1,347.88, money she borrowed from me in 2011 in order to bail her cousin out of jail for, and I'm quoting from the police report, an obscene act with a gazebo. Number two, that whole Dwight putting sprinkles the cat into the freezer subplot from The Office? That wasn't fiction. That actually happened. And it was homicidal Jenna who did it. And it was based on my cat, Sniffles. True story. I would often bring Sniffles into work and keep him in my trailer. Jenna loved that darn cat. So when I had to fly to New York to shoot a commercial for Del Taco, of course I let her cat sit. Why wouldn't I? Long story short, got back to town, heard some sob story about Sniffles accidentally eating some expired pickles, and then got delivered a dead cat popsicle in a Ziploc bag by none other than Jenna Jeffrey Dahmer Fisher. Number three, Angela killed Oscar. I mean, if she hasn't yet, she probably will. It's just a matter of time. Number four, the two of them mocked Steve Carell so much right to his face that he was forced to leave the show several seasons earlier than the rest of the cast. That's why he really left. Their incessant emotional bullying of him was completely overlooked by the authorities at NBC and took a devastating psychological toll on him. To this day, he can't say the word Angela or even Angel without breaking down into gasping, snot-ridden sobs. You've all seen Carell's nose, so you know that's a lot of snot. Number five. This is the most explosive of all my revelations, and one that will rock Office fandom to the core. Jenna and Angela are so simple-minded that within 3 days of shooting The Office pilot, they became confused and believed they actually were two women named Pam Beasley and Angela Martin, shooting an actual documentary in Scranton, Pennsylvania. All of us in the cast and crew were in shock that these two seemingly normal actresses could be so suggestible and empty-headed as to lose track of their own identities. However, the footage we were getting with them was so hilarious that all of us huddled together and made a secret pact. We would allow Pam and Angela to believe their incredibly idiotic delusion. All the scripts we'd had were thrown out, which was fine because the writers were useless anyway. Instead, I and the rest of my castmates simply interacted with Pam and Angela, having real spontaneous moments. Then, after 9 years, the guilt weighed too heavily upon us, and we broke down and told Jenna Fisher and Angela Kinsey, the truth. So, In a sense, The Office really was a documentary, real moments shared between skilled actors like myself and two oblivious, impossibly idiotic women. While it may disappoint you podcast listeners to know your heroes could be such misguided dum-dums, I hope you take solace in the fact that when you see emotional moments on The Office between Dwight and Angela or Dwight and Pam, the feelings you see me express for them are very real. Jenna, Angela, I love you both. Everyone else from The Office? Not so much. Wilson out. Please don't hurt me. Hashtag RIP Sniffles.
Wow. That was.
Well, we did tell him he could say anything.
For the record, I believed in Pam's pickles.
I know you did, and I've always appreciated your support on that.
You're welcome. We are so grateful to Creed and Rain for helping us kick off our audiobook.
We're going to have more folks popping in to help us out. Oscar Nunez, Brian Baumgartner, Ellie Kemper, Steve Carell, Ed Helms, Kate Flannery, and Jennifer Garner.
What a cool lineup. Look at us go.
Well, on with the show. Dedication. For our families, Lee, Weston, and Harper.
Josh, Isabel, Jack, and Cade. We love you all so much. Introduction.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
We were on The Office together.
And we're best friends.
We are also moms, business partners, podcasters, lovers of knickknacks, sometime hikers, avid scrapbookers, and wine and canvas artists. And now, we are the co-authors of this book.
If you are listening to this, that means you bought our book! Thank you! If we could hug you, we would. We are huggers.
We are.
Yes.
We're going to hug you.
I'm hugging you.
This is an audible hug.
Yes, this is us hugging you. Between producing a weekly podcast, multiple Target runs, and getting snacks for the kids, do your kids snack as much as ours do? You might wonder, why did these busy ladies add writing a book to their list? I'll tell you. In April 2018, Jenna and I both decided to do a big spring cleaning of our garages, attics, basements, and sheds. Basically, all the places where we stash random stuff. Both of us had been putting off this task for years, so we decided to do it together. While digging through our boxes, we found tons of office memorabilia, journals of our time on set, piles of photos of everybody and everything, and little mementos we had collected along the way. I also found out that I apparently hoard baskets. I had 32 of them. Jenna hoards old lamps that no longer work. But that's a story for our next book, Baskets and Old Lamps, Tales of Two Ladies Who Hoard. Finding our office treasures sparked lots of memories and gave us the idea to start our weekly podcast, Office Ladies, which we launched in October 2019. We'd had a great time rewatching the show and breaking down episodes each week, but what about all of our amazing photos and our other best friend stories? Rather than keep these wonderful items to ourselves, we decided to use them to create a book.
This book is several things: a scrapbook, a BFF journal, and a love letter to fans of our show. We like to think that if something happened back then, one of us documented the moment. We couldn't be more excited to share our memories, photos, stories from life on set of The Office, and details of our friendship of more than 18 years.
Our first challenge was figuring out how to write this book together. Well, folks, we love a good chat. During our writing sessions, I would start a story, and then Jenna would jump in with her memories and vice versa. So, get a cozy chair and curl up with us, because we are going to share our memories with you the best way we know how. By chatting back and forth, as BFFs do.
And, thanks to this book, our garages are now clean and ready to fill with more stuff. Angela has already started collecting new baskets. I'm telling you, the woman can't pass a basket without buying it. If you really want to make her heart sing, send her a gift that comes in a beautiful basket. It's like you're giving her two gifts. Anyway, we really hope you like our book. We worked hard on it. That's what she said. Chapter 1. job opening. Office work.
In 2003, a group of strangers had one very big thing in common. We had all just been cast on a new TV comedy pilot called The Office. After years of living as struggling artists, we were all very happy to be employed and doing what we loved. We could never have predicted the impact it would have on the rest of our lives.
I have an old photo from my first day of work on The Office. It was taken when Steve Carell, John Krasinski, Rainn Wilson, BJ Novak, David Denman, Phyllis Smith, and I met with the producers, network executives, showrunner Greg Daniels, and director Ken Kwapis to do a table read of the pilot script for the very first time. Allison Jones, our casting director, came to the table read armed with a plate of homemade chocolate chip cookies and a Polaroid camera. I desperately wanted a picture to commemorate the day, and this was before everyone had cameras on their phones. So I was excited when she told us all to gather together for a photo. I asked if she would take one for me, too. She said sure, took a second picture, and handed me the Polaroid and a cookie. I remember standing and munching the cookie while watching the photo slowly develop before my eyes. To let you know how special this whole moment was, let me share a little about my backstory. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. From the time I was 7 years old, I knew I wanted to be an actor. I can't say why exactly, but I barely remember a time when this wasn't my goal. At age 9, I considered becoming a veterinarian, but when I learned I would have to do surgeries on animals, I went back to my original plan of actor. My parents were very supportive, but also refused to let me act professionally as a child. And it's not like there were a ton of opportunities in St. Louis, to be honest. They told me I had to graduate from high school and college before moving to Los Angeles. So I auditioned for every school play and joined every drama club. I spent most of high school in the dancing chorus until my senior year when I was cast as the fiddler in The Fiddler on the Roof. I had no lines but extra solo dancing. I went to college at a small liberal arts school in rural Missouri called Truman State University and majored in theater. I learned a lot about acting technique, and my love of performing was solidified. After graduation, I packed up my Mazda 323 hatchback and drove across the country to Los Angeles, ready to give it a go in Hollywood. I ended up spending years in various odd jobs, trying to pay off my defaulted credit card and make my rent. Thanks to a mandatory typing class in high school, most of the jobs I found were working as, wait for it, a receptionist. In the meantime, I was going on hundreds of auditions and performing Commedia dell'arte with a local theater company. I earned my Screen Actors Guild card doing background work, experience that would come in handy later, as you will learn in this book, and each year I seemed to do a little better than the year before. I booked some guest appearances on television shows, a couple of independent films, and a pilot called Rubbing Charlie. Yes, you heard that right. It was a comedy, starring a stressed-out doctor named Charlie, played by Scott Wolf, who gets life lessons from his massage therapist, me. I actually rubbed Charlie. It was a really sweet and funny show. I was convinced it would be my big break. So when it didn't make it past the pilot stage, I was crushed. I told my manager I wanted to quit, the years of rejection having taken their toll, and my new plan was to apply to vet technician school. Animal care with no surgeries. She told me to keep at it, that the right role would find me if I just didn't give up. I had my doubts. At that point, I'd been plugging away in Los Angeles for nearly 8 years, but I decided to take her advice and give it one more year. As fate would have it, the following pilot season, I was asked to audition for the American remake of a BBC show called The Office. The role was for the receptionist, Pam, a worn-down yet still hopeful young woman with artistic dreams beyond her depressing day job. In other words, me. After we snapped the shot, Steve Carell said, "One day this photo will be worth money, especially after they fire me and replace me with a new actor for episode 2. You'll all look at this and say, aw, remember Steve, what's his name? He was sweet. I wonder what he's up to now." Before The Office, Steve had the most experience of all of us. He wasn't a household name by any means, but he had been a correspondent on The Daily Show. He'd been a regular on The Dana Carvey Show, and he'd had a scene-stealing role opposite Jim Carrey in the movie Bruce Almighty. He had also been rejected by Saturday Night Live and been cast in more than one failed pilot. He knew better than all of us how rough and random our business could be. Rainn Wilson had been knocking around for about 10 years, traveling the country doing Shakespeare, and most recently worked as a recurring character on Six Feet Under. Phyllis had spent the previous 19 years working in casting, including 8 as a casting associate for Allison Jones. When we all came in to audition for The Office, Phyllis was our reader. Ken Kwapis was so taken with her, he told showrunner Greg Daniels he thought she should play a role on the show. John Krasinski had done some commercials, and like me, his last pilot was not picked up. BJ Novak had been doing stand-up comedy when Greg discovered him. David Denman was like Steve. He'd been an employed yet mostly unknown actor for years, having appeared in a number of studio films and miniseries. He'd also done 4 pilots, none of which ever made it to series. We all laughed at Steve's joke, but the truth is, we were all also secretly wondering if we'd get to episode 2. Also there that day were the creators of the original version of The Office, Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant. I had watched every episode of the British series and naturally was a huge fan. I was in awe of Lucy Davis's portrayal of Dawn, Pam's British counterpart. She could communicate so much with just a glance. I hoped that I could bring as much heart and depth to Pam as Lucy did to Dawn. As I sat with the creators of this masterpiece, I remember thinking, if I lose this job tomorrow, at least I got to sit in the same room as Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant. After the read, Ricky and Stephen gave us ideas for how to best Americanize the show. This had been the subject of a lot of discussion amongst the creative team. In England, they do much shorter television seasons. The original Office series was only 12 episodes long in total, with 1 Christmas special. American networks expect a lot more than that. A typical American television show makes 24 episodes per season. Ricky noted that if we hoped to make 100 episodes, we should be sure people didn't become too frustrated by Michael's incompetence. He suggested we make him a buffoon, but still good at his job. That way, American viewers would find something to admire in Michael amidst all the annoyance. Stephen Merchant then said that the Jim and Pam relationship was another way to balance Michael's obnoxious behavior. He said, "Always remember, Jim and Pam are the heart of the show." Gulp, no pressure.
I did not grow up in Los Angeles either. I grew up in Indonesia, by way of Louisiana and Texas. My dad was a drilling engineer, and we moved around for his job. I always knew I wanted to be a performer. My mom loves to tell the story about when she asked me and my older sisters what we wanted to be when we grew up. All my sisters had funny responses, but mine, she said, was the most puzzling. My sister Billy said she wanted to be, quote, the boss. Janet wanted to be a truck driver like her Uncle Carl, Tina a gymnast, and I wanted to be Carol Burnett. I was 4. My dad had shown me the Carol Burnett show, and all I wanted to do for the rest of my life was be a comedian. My first big break was getting cast as Mary in the Christmas play at school. Not a lot of jokes were written for Mary, but hey, it was a lead role. During college, I would write stand-up bits and try them out for my friends. I had grown up watching David Letterman's monologues and would even memorize some of his routines. I was desperate to learn more about comedy writing, and after 4 years at Baylor University and a bachelor's degree, I headed to New York City to intern for Late Night with Conan O'Brien. When I interviewed for my position on Conan, I was told only 2 interns were ever on the stage during rehearsals and tapings, the writer's intern and the band's intern. All the other interns were up in the offices. I was determined to have access to those rehearsals. That's where Conan and Andy Richter and the writers would work out his stand-up routine and sketches. Well, the writer's intern position had already been filled, so I told them I wanted to be the band's intern. They asked me if I knew anything about music. I lied and said, "Of course, music is my life." I got the job, and learned that if you make a friend at SIR, Studio Instrument Rentals, you can fake it until you make it as a music intern. I spent my weekdays watching Conan and my weekends taking acting classes. A friend of mine had given me Uta Hagen's book, A Challenge for the Actor, and I was lucky enough to take a workshop from Carol Rosenfeld at the acting school started by Uta Hagen herself, HB Studio. Watching Conan and studying at HB Studio boosted my confidence, and I decided to move to Los Angeles to try to be a television actor. At this point, I was working two jobs and auditioning constantly. I had had a string of national commercials, most notably for Buick, Chrysler, and Lay's Wow chips with Olestra. Yes, the chips that gave everyone abdominal cramping, diarrhea, and anal leakage. Between auditions, I was an operator at 1-800-DENTIST and ran the intern program at the iOS Comedy Club. I had been performing improv three nights a week for a decade. You know that annoying friend who was constantly handing you a flyer for their show? That was me. During this time, I was married to Warren Lieberstein and related by marriage to Greg Daniels. Greg and his wife, Suzanne, Warren's sister, were always very supportive and came to several of my shows. In the summer of 2003, Suzanne invited us over for a swim. I coveted these afternoon swims because our tiny apartment had only one AC window unit, and summers were rough. I had wedged myself into one of their daughter's brightly colored floaties and was trying to paddle to the steps of the pool when Greg sat down to chat. He told us he was going to be remaking the BBC version of The Office. I remember trying to suppress a uh-oh look on my face. A few other major networks tried to bring BBC shows to the United States and failed. The sensibility and tone of a show for a British audience had not transferred well to an American audience. I loved the BBC version of The Office and was worried that making it for an American audience would be a disaster. But I also felt that if anyone could pull it off, it would be Greg. He had been writing and producing on hit television shows for years and had won several awards for Saturday Night Live, The Simpsons, and a show he co-created, King of the Hill. Greg is one of the most brilliantly funny people you will ever meet on a set or off. He suggested I come in and audition because he thought that my improv background would lend itself to the mockumentary style of the show. Plus, he wanted to use as many unknown actors as he could. Greg felt that the world of a small paper company in Scranton, Pennsylvania, would feel more organic if there were no big Hollywood names in the mix. I was definitely not a big Hollywood name, unless Lay's Wow Potato Chip Lady counted. I was very excited for the opportunity, but also incredibly nervous. Greg told me he would put my name on the list to audition, but with one caveat. No one could know that we were related. Greg felt strongly that letting this information get out to the network would only hurt my chances. We decided that we would not acknowledge each other at the audition. He could get me in the room, but I had to win the room over on my own. I later learned that this ruse was Allison Jones's idea. She was a big champion of mine and had told Greg this was the best plan. Thank you, Allison! On November 17, 2003, I auditioned for the role of Pam. Yep, fact. I signed into the audition at 2:40 p.m. and was the 16th person that day to read for the role of our favorite receptionist. I know this not because I have an amazing memory, but because the incredible Allison Jones saved my audition sign-in sheet. When the series wrapped 9 years later, she gave it to me as a farewell gift. I ugly cried, of course. I treasure owning this piece of my life history. So many amazing people were there on that same day. Every female comedian I knew went in for the role of Pam. I remember my audition very clearly. It's weird how the brain captures the biggest moments of your life and slows them down. Every single detail is stuck in my brain. I wore a pink sweater and a black pencil skirt. I had worked really hard to prepare my scenes. I waited in a very small room before my audition. Katherine Hahn was sitting on a sofa in the corner. We smiled at each other and said hello. She is a doll and so talented, I tried my best not to get anxious. I am not sweaty by nature. I usually run cold no matter the temperature, but as it got closer to my turn, I really began to sweat. I actually went into the bathroom and dabbed toilet paper in my armpits. Sorry for the overshare, but that's how nervous I was. When it was finally my time, I walked into a room full of producers. There was a camera on a tripod, and sitting beside the camera was the casting associate, Phyllis, my future party planning committee rival. I was to read with her. Greg was sitting in the very back of the room, and neither of us made eye contact. My agent told me they were having everyone read two scenes, but if they liked you, they asked you to do a third. Phyllis and I read my first two scenes, and everyone was laughing. It felt great. Then I was asked to do a third. I worked hard to contain my excitement. Phyllis and I began the final scene, the one where Michael fake fires Pam in front of Ryan the temp. To jog your memory, in the scene, Michael wants to prank Pam by pretending to fire her for stealing post-it notes. The fake firing goes terribly wrong, and Pam is very upset. She starts to cry and calls Michael a jerk. The scene was going well. Phyllis was killing it as Michael. Imagine someone with Phyllis's sweet face smugly telling you that you've been punked. When we got to the part where I was supposed to tear up and call Michael a jerk, I really let Michael slash Phyllis have it. Now, there are three times you can tell I am from Texas. When I am tired, tipsy, or pissed off. So I definitely slipped into a southern drawl as I growled, "Jerk!" The room of producers burst out laughing, and I remember thinking, not so sure I'm supposed to get a laugh at this point, but okay. And that was it. Allison thanked me for coming in. Greg discreetly smiled from the back row and gave me a thumbs up, and I walked out of there on cloud nine. I just knew I had that part. The next day, I got a call from Allison. I did not get that part. She told me they really liked me but thought I was a little too feisty for Pam. I was disappointed, of course, but I felt good about my audition and I was thankful for the opportunity. So I let it go and I moved on. That's just what you have to do as an actor. Plus, I had another audition that week for an improv pilot that I was really excited about. It was about a group of people working at a hair salon in New York City for the Oxygen Network. The working title was Salon Royale. I auditioned for the role of the promiscuous receptionist. Feisty was no problem here. And I was cast. The producers of that show flew me out to New York City first class. I had never flown first class for work, and it felt so fancy. The cast was full of amazing improvisers, Ian Roberts, Beth Cahill, Dave Rosowski, and the show was written and directed by Emmy Laybourne. Emmy's mom, Geraldine, was the president of Oxygen at the time, so I thought we had a good shot of making it to series. But alas, we didn't get picked up. So back to Los Angeles I went. After back-to-back rejections, I was feeling pretty discouraged about acting. I decided to concentrate my energy on writing and put acting on hold for a while. Several weeks went by, and I was feeling good about my decision to lean into writing. And then I got a call that changed everything. I was working the box office at iOS when I got a call on my flip phone. Remember those? It was a number I didn't recognize, so I let it go to voicemail. As it turns out, it was from Allison Jones's office. The producers of The Office wanted to see me again for a new role, the prickly lady in accounting. Allison told me the creative team thought I was right for the world of Dunder Mifflin, just not quite right for Pam. This time there was no big room full of producers, it was just the director, Ken Quapis, Phyllis, and the tripod. I was told to come in wearing something drab, my hair plain, and with little to no makeup. Apparently, the prickly lady in accounting was no fashion plate. I wore a light blue turtleneck sweater with a gray cardigan and black pants, pulled my hair back in a low ponytail, and left my face bare. I channeled all my sass, and I got the part! And I was pretty sure that the prickly accountant would be an easier role for my mom to talk about at her ladies' Bible study than the lustful salon receptionist. So everything worked out. I am so grateful to Greg for getting me in that room on November 17th. That moment changed my life forever. And little did I know, the gal that was cast in the role of Pam would become my best friend forever.
Before we started taping the first episode, Ken Quapis suggested we all personalize our desks. I loved this idea. Because of my real-life office experience, I had very strong feelings about the types of supplies a receptionist should have on their desk. The invitation to personalize my workspace made me very excited. Ken also suggested John Krasinski and I spend some time getting to know each other outside of work. Have lunch. Have coffee. Create a rapport, was the suggestion, as it will translate on screen. This is common for actors who are cast in a new project together. It's key to try and get to know the people you're going to be pretending to be in a relationship with so you don't seem like total strangers on screen. For example, during rehearsals for my job on ABC's Splitting Up Together, Oliver Hudson and I spent 2 days hanging out with the 3 children who would play our kids on the show. Like real parents, we sat reading each other bits of news articles off our phones while the kids wrestled. When I did the movie Hall Pass, I had drinks with Owen Wilson, who was playing my husband. Incidentally, I did not meet up with Scott Wolf before Rubbing Charlie, and, well, you already know how that worked out. Note, Scott Wolf is a delightful human being, and I adore him. It is not our fault the show didn't go. We were fantastic. And I couldn't forget what Stephen Merchant had said, that John and I, virtual strangers, were to be the heart of the show. So, one night after rehearsals, we decided to kill 2 birds with 1 stone. John Krasinski and I went to a nearby office supply store and shopped for things to decorate our desks. I got a label maker, message pad, message sorter, daily calendar, file folders, multicolored sticky notes. The list goes on and on. I left with 2 bags of supplies. I think John got a tape dispenser and maybe some post-it notes. The whole time we were shopping, we just kept talking about how excited we were to start shooting. We wanted to do everything we could to go from pilot to series. John also shared about moving from New York and the adjustment to living in Los Angeles. I was happy to learn that we were both pretty boring people, in a good way. He felt stable. He had a good work ethic, and he was funny. We laughed a lot. I could tell he was going to be a good acting partner.
Greg had encouraged us to think about our characters and their backstories, so when it came to my desk area, I tried to imagine what a stuffy lady in accounting might bring to the office. I brought in a photo of my grandmother Lena and me. In the picture, my eyes are closed, but I am smiling. It makes me laugh that Angela Martin would choose to frame a photo where her eyes are closed. Like, perhaps that was just the best one of the bunch? I also brought in a day planner. I felt like Angela Martin would have an appointment book and it would be very comprehensive. The set dressers put a blue ceramic cat paperclip holder on my desk. The cat's left ear was slightly chipped, and I loved that little detail. It looked like a knickknack you would get from a garage sale in a small town. That cat paperclip holder did a lot to inform who Angela Martin was. It was clear to me that she must love cats, and that she didn't need fancy new things to make her happy. She was too humble for fancy. In a judgmental way, of course. People ask us all the time what we took from the set the day we wrapped the series, and I took that cat paperclip holder. It sits on my desk at home to this day.
Walking onto the set for our first day of shooting, I was so nervous. I'd left my house at 5 a.m. for what was a 45-minute commute. I made myself a song mix I affectionately titled Songs of Scranton. I drank coffee and bounced along the freeway. I tried to imagine I was driving to my real job at a real paper company in Scranton, Pennsylvania. When I arrived, I was taken to wardrobe. There were a lot of very quick introductions to various other cast members who were coming and going between wardrobe, hair, and makeup. It was then that I first met Leslie David Baker, who would soon be known to many as Stanley Hudson. He was so warm, friendly, and open that watching him switch over to Stanley, the checked-out grump, was hilarious. Our director had requested that everyone be on set and at our desks at 7:30 a.m. sharp. He asked us all to pretend to work while the film crew recorded us. He wanted to capture us like real documentarians would, because this was the convention of the show. We were real office workers being filmed by a documentary film crew. When we were all in place, the set was cleared of all crew members except for the camera operator, boom operator, and director. They started rolling, and it all felt so real. It was very quiet at first. Then Phyllis and Leslie started improvising fake sales calls. I started to answer the phone and transfer calls. A lot of the shots you see in the opening credits of the show are from that very first morning.
I was also a bundle of nerves that first day. My call time to set was 4:30 a.m., so I didn't get much sleep the night before. We were filming in an empty office building in Culver City, California. The building was only two stories, and we filmed on the second floor. There was an empty sound stage next to the main building where the hair and makeup team was set up. It was cold and dark when I arrived, with only one small space heater in that big drafty room. We huddled around it and waited our turn. Our director had instructed the hair and makeup departments to keep our looks very simple. I was given a loose French braid and some powder and lip balm. That's all. The wardrobe department asked me to bring the clothes and shoes I had worn to my audition for Angela Martin, so I actually wore my own clothes in the pilot. With barely any hair and makeup and no wardrobe fitting, it didn't take much time for me to get ready. I walked onto the set early and realized I wasn't sure where I was supposed to sit. Ken Kwapis must have seen me looking around sort of lost. He came over to me and told me I'd be sitting in the corner in what would become the accounting department. He walked me over to introduce me to my deskmates. There I found seated at the desk right next to me, Oscar Nunez. I had known Oscar for years. We first met at the Groundlings and then went on to perform together in a sketch comedy show called Hot Towel. I played a horny Boy Scout and Oscar a crazy professor. I was so thrilled to see my old friend that I yelled out, "Holy crap, Oscar!" Neither of us knew that the other had been cast. This was in the antiquated times before everything everyone is doing and saying was posted online. You could still be surprised by things. Imagine that. One of the very first photos I took on the office set was of the accounting department. We took the photo in character, and it cracks me up that even in the first week, Oscar, Kevin, and Angela were clearly formed people. We already knew who we were in the world of the show. I think it speaks to how amazing the writing was on The Office, and also to Allison Jones and her gift for assembling acting ensembles.
I'll never forget seeing Angela pop her head up over the partition between our desks to introduce herself. Her face barely made it over the edge as she said, "Hello," in her bubbly Texas twang. She was instantly funny, upbeat, and kind. I liked her immediately. She was clearly nothing like her character, Angela Martin, which shows what a great actress she is. In addition to our chats over the partition, Angela would talk my ear off in the hair and makeup room, and she would keep talking as we walked to the snack table and then to set. I often joke that I had no choice but to become friends with Angela because she wouldn't stop talking to me. I was so grateful for her. I was nervous, and she was an instant comfort.
My first memory of Jenna is hearing a little dainty sneeze come from behind the partition next to my desk. It reminded me of my neighbor's peek-a-poo sneezing. It was adorable. She sat directly behind me and was physically the closest gal to me on set. Jenna seemed shy, but then again, I am super chatty, and I probably scared her. I can do that to people. Every day that first week, I'd get up on my tippy toes and pop my head over and chat. Those desk partition chats became our daily habit for the next 9 years.
The whole week seemed to speed by so fast. Before we knew it, the pilot was done, and we all went home to wait the almost 3 months it took to learn if our show would make it to series. Shortly after we'd filmed the pilot, I went to London for a friend's wedding. While I was there, I reached out to Ricky and Steven to see if they were able to meet. I don't know where I got the courage to call, but since I'd basically been unemployed since shooting the pilot for The Office, this was the one potentially exciting thing I had in my life. I wanted to milk it for all it was worth. They agreed to host me for lunch at the exclusive Groucho Club. The Groucho is a famed private club for comedians, and I couldn't believe I was there. I don't like to think too much about that lunch because I'm certain I sounded like a raving idiot, going on and praising their genius nonstop. They must have taken pity on me because they even agreed to pose for a photo afterward. After the lunch, I was sitting on the tube reading a discarded UK TV guide. Inside was an article about the casting of the American version of The Office. How crazy is that? The article was not positive. It said, quote, The chances of NBC actually matching wits with the original are about as good as finding a designated driver at a Wembley football match, end quote. It included photos of the original cast members alongside photos of each of us from the American version. The article basically went on to break down how we were ill-suited for the roles and would ruin the show. It ended by predicting our show would be as palatable as, quote, a plate of mushy peas, end quote. Huh. How did I feel about this? I'll tell you. My photo was in a magazine! I was blown away! It was the first time I'd ever been in a magazine. I tore out the article and tucked it into my purse. For years, I saved every press clipping about our show, even if I wasn't mentioned at all. I can't explain it exactly, but from the very beginning, this show felt special. It felt different from the rest. I wanted to keep a record of every moment, even the ones where we were compared to mushy peas. About 2 months later, Greg called and said he'd finished editing the pilot episode and sent it off to the network. He wanted to share it with the cast. If the folks at UK TV Guide were right, it would be the only episode of the American version of The Office ever produced, so we wanted to celebrate. I offered to host a viewing party. It's something that would become an ongoing tradition when the show was on the air. We'd switch houses each week, watching it together. But this was the first. Everyone gathered at my house. I moved the furniture around in an effort to accommodate everyone, but there were so many people that folks were sitting on the floor, including Steve Carell. We ordered pizza and got set to watch.
At first, you couldn't get your DVD player to work.
Yes, I was mortified. Everyone was in my house, sitting on my floor, waiting to see this show that we'd worked so hard on. It was so much pressure.
After some colorful language and trying a few different plugs, you changed the batteries in your remote and got it working. Night saved.
And, if I remember correctly, we watched it twice. We all told Greg how much we loved it, and we did. We felt good about what we had created. Greg told us he had no idea which way the network was leaning and that we'd have to wait another month to find out. A month! How in the world was I going to fill the next 30 days without going out of my mind? I decided to stalk more original Office cast members. My manager, Naomi Odenkirk, had a client who was shooting a pilot with Lucy Davis. I went to the taping and met her afterward. She was bubbly and smiley. She told me how the Office had changed her life and wished me all the same success. I asked for a photo, of course. Then I went home and waited. And waited. And waited.
During our month wait, I went home to visit my family's farm in Texas. It's about 300 acres in the middle of nowhere. My dad would wake me up early in the morning to feed the cows. When I wasn't helping my dad, I was helping my mom and grandmother shell pecans. Hollywood felt very far away, and I was thankful for the distraction. While I was there, I got the news that NBC had picked up 5 more episodes of The Office. We were officially a series. My whole family was so excited. They knew what a long journey this had been for me. Mom said we should celebrate, so she put on a pot roast. A pot roast and homemade rolls. Birdie Joe, that's my mom's name, was going all out. Some meals you remember for your whole life, and that was one of them for me. Good news and a good pot roast, a celebration indeed.
When I got the call that the show was getting picked up, I screamed. My very pragmatic agents congratulated me and then, I guess to temper my expectations, told me that 5 episodes was a very small order and it indicated very little confidence in the show. They were basically saying, have fun, but don't spend all your money in one place. In fact, my agents continued to send me other pilot scripts while we were shooting season 1 of The Office. A recurring theme of our early years was people explaining to us how our show would never really make it. I told them I was simply excited to be employed for now. I couldn't wait to get back to work with everyone again. Our pilot had been a direct adaptation of the British pilot script, but the network wanted the next 5 episodes to be original. Greg assembled a staff of writers to start breaking down stories for the first all-original episodes. That group was Mindy Kaling, Mike Schur, and BJ Novak, plus three consultants, Paul Lieberstein, Larry Wilmore, and Lester Lewis. One of the first stories they came up with was based on a real-life experience of their writer's assistant, Tom Huang. When Tom was in college, he took a class in which they did an exercise where they had to put note cards on their foreheads with different ethnicities, and then they had to go around and regard one another as that ethnicity using stereotypes. This turned into Diversity Day. BJ Novak, who was only 25 years old at the time, was tasked with writing the episode, which the writing staff nicknamed The Pilot After the Pilot. It would establish what the audience could expect from the American version of The Office moving forward. Good thing for us, BJ nailed it.
The morning we filmed Michael Scott's Diversity Day seminar, the props department handed us our note cards and showed us how to place them on our foreheads. They were taped to our foreheads at 7:30 a.m., and we wore those cards for 12 hours. We only took them off at lunchtime. Hours went by, and we forgot all about them. Mine said Jamaica. I wish I had taken a picture of us on our snack break. Imagine seeing the cast eating nachos with these ridiculous cards on their foreheads. Standing by the salsa bar was Jenna, with Jewish taped to her forehead, talking to Brian, with Italian taped to his. By the end of the day, the double-stick tape had left skinny, rectangular bald spots on our foreheads. But it was worth it. The cast was completely in sync. All our reactions, every moment, felt perfect. I remember looking around that conference room and thinking, oh my God, if we can just get people to watch the show, we're going to be a hit. From the very beginning, it felt like the cast of The Office had a group mind. Bear with me, but this group mind idea is from the improv world, and I always relate back to that. By group mind, I mean we had this shared comedic collective consciousness. When you are performing improv as a group, no single person leads. The goal is to find your way together, listening, reacting, and being in the moment. I felt like our cast had this kind of comedic mind meld. The magic came from a combination of great writing and smart casting, but I think it was also due to the fact that the original cast shared a lot of history with one another. You already know that I knew Greg by marriage, and as a result, Paul as well, and that I had performed with Oscar in sketch comedy shows. But I also knew Kate Flannery, our saucy Meredith. For years, Kate and I performed improv together at IO West. But wait, there's more. Jenna and I had been living a few blocks apart as struggling artists, using the same grocery store, but never met. Jenna, Phyllis, and director Ken Kwapis are all from St. Louis. Brian Baumgartner and Rainn Wilson had done regional theater together. Then there's the fact that BJ Novak and John Krasinski were childhood friends in Newton, Massachusetts, and even played in the same Little League baseball division. Do you see what I mean here? For the most part, we were a group of strangers, yet somehow it felt like destiny that we would all come together on this show. You take these people whose lives have been crisscrossing for years, and you put them in a tiny little office, write them amazing scripts, and it was comedic lightning in a bottle.
It's impossible to predict if a television show or movie project will be a success. And with The Office, we spent the first two seasons believing we could be canceled at any moment. No one looked at this group of people and said, bingo, we've got a hit television show on our hands. But what you did feel, standing on that set all together, was magic. You could feel the chemistry of these people that Greg had so masterfully gathered together. And that includes our writers, directors, and crew. Every person on set was essential. It's just as Angela said. It was as if we'd been crisscrossing one another our whole lives up until that point just for this purpose. Every role we hadn't gotten, every show before that didn't go, made it, so we were now together for this one. We had no idea if fans would like the show, or how long the magic would last. We were all just grateful to be there, creating something together.
Chapter 2. World's Best Job.
Between the two of us, we've worked on a lot of film and television projects over the years. We can say with authority that The Office was a truly special place to work. One of the unique features of the office set was the ease of collaboration between the different departments.
This was no accident. Showrunner Greg Daniels had a vision for an innovative method of making television that centered around giving everyone a voice in the process. The magic that was created from his system was, as Michael Scott might say, incalculable.
Find a job you love and you'll never work another day in your life. I remember hearing this phrase when I was a kid, and it pretty much describes my time working on The Office. A typical episode of The Office took 1 week to shoot. An average day of shooting was about 12 hours long. So, quick math, that's about 60 hours on set each week. But it never felt like work.
Generally, when you're shooting a movie or television show, you do a scene with one or two other actors, and then you go home or back to your trailer to wait to shoot another. But on The Office, our set was just one big room. Even if you weren't speaking in the scene, you were still part of the background. With two cameras running at all times, you were always going to be on camera. There was no heading off to your trailer for a break. We were all in it together, all the time. The reality was that many of our work hours were spent in the background of our castmates' scenes.
And that was true for everyone, even the star of our show, Steve Carell. I remember once, after spending a particularly long time in the background, Steve came out of Michael's office and said to me, "Oh my gosh, I understand why Michael is always coming out of his office to chat with people. It's so lonely in there." I understood. Pam's desk was lonely too. I would look across the room and wish I had a desk mate. I spent a lot of my background time playing Free Cell, not really that different from what I did at my countless day jobs as a real receptionist. At that time, none of our computers on our desks had internet, but they were equipped with games. This led to some pretty fierce Free Cell competitions between the cast and crew. For those not familiar, Free Cell is basically solitaire, but all the cards are dealt face up. The goal is to solve the deal in as few moves as possible. Playing this game became an obsession. The crew played during breaks, and the cast played while in the background of scenes. I think Kate Flannery holds the record for all-time best score with the fewest moves, but Phyllis was also pretty darn good.
I could only play solitaire for so long before I'd get antsy. I spent the majority of my background time writing in my journal or doodling. I kept a set of colored pencils in my desk drawer, and there was never a shortage of paper, of course. So I would draw. Oscar would also draw, and he is really good. He would often pass me notes with elaborate drawings during a scene to try to make me laugh. They were usually of the accounting department or an illustration of a story I had told him. One day he drew a picture of himself looking dapper, drinking a martini, while Brian and I, as Angela and Kevin, scooted by him on a scooter. Then there was the day I told him I got a new litter box for my cat. He drew that too. I saved many of them.
Angela and I are both big journal gals. When the gang took a break from fighting it out on Free Cell, I also spent my background time writing in my journal or making shopping lists. Steve read film scripts in his office, or sometimes the newspaper, but he'd have to hide them inside of something Michael would actually read, like Cracked or American Way. Rain was one of the first in the cast to upgrade from a flip phone to a BlackBerry. He was instantly addicted. We were jealous that he could read and answer emails on set. Phyllis sometimes paid her bills and balanced her checkbook in the background of scenes. If you look closely at episodes during season one, you can see her writing checks. I used to worry someone would pause their TV, zoom in, and steal her account and routing numbers. This probably isn't possible, but that's how my brain works. I have a little Dwight in me. That's what she said.
Being in the background also meant we had to be in character all day, every day. In our little accounting corner, we would come up with ridiculous, improvised office work to try to make one another laugh. For instance, Oscar would play with his giant adding machine. Imagine an adding machine from the 1970s, much like the phone E.T. built to call home. The keys were so enormous that the machine was nearly the size of his computer keyboard. I don't know where the props department got that thing, but I imagine it had lived in an NBC storage vault for decades. I would look over at Oscar, and he would be very judiciously adding numbers from a spreadsheet, hitting the buttons with only his knuckles. Brian pretended to work using a giant red pencil that was actually a piggy bank.
I like to take fake phone calls, get annoyed at the fake caller, roll my eyes, and then hang up in a huff.
Kate and I had a long-running background improvisation about how corporate had recently converted to a confusing new computer program for logging sales orders. It was all based on some prop sales sheets we found in a folder. We decided the new program was faulty because the printed sales sheets categorized items using an all-numeric sales code, while the new computer program used an alphanumeric code. Different codes for different systems. Such a typical corporate snafu and totally something office mates would complain about. We did this improvisation for years when our characters were paired together in the background of scenes, quietly lamenting the idiocy of the new system. I really wish I still had one of those sales sheets. If I did, I'd frame it and give it to Kate as a gift.
In the pilot episode, everyone in the office is worried about rumored downsizing. I had two scripted lines. I bet it's going to be me. Probably going to be me. In response, Kevin said, "Yeah, it'll be you." That was it. The rest of the week, I was only in the background. That meant I had a lot of time to kill. All that downtime gave birth to Sprinkles. As any fan of The Office knows, Sprinkles is my character Angela Martin's beloved fluffy white cat. But what you might not know is that the entire Sprinkle storyline was birthed on a single green post-it note during the pilot episode. Ken Kwapis, our director, asked some of the supporting cast to help fill out the background of scenes by doing busy work in various parts of the bullpen. If you rewatch the pilot, you'll see a few of these moments. Kevin is going through packages at the mail cart, I make copies at the photocopier, and then there were people crossing behind the interviews in the conference room. The writers called the interviews between Dunder Mifflin employees and the documentarians talking heads. Ken was establishing the world of the mockumentary, and in those early days, they wanted people crossing behind the talking heads to show the hustle and bustle of an office. He asked me if I would make a big loop through the bullpen passing out papers. I was so thrilled to have something to do. I asked him what he wanted me to give out. He told me it didn't matter. Clearly, this was not a plot-propelling moment. Earlier, while at my desk, I had doodled a little cat on a post-it note. This gave me an idea. I made a bunch more and wrote on each one, "It's Sprinkle's third birthday. Come celebrate! Tuesday in the parking lot." I had the idea that Angela found a cat in the parking lot and adopted it. Its third birthday was coming up, and she was going to make sure everyone acknowledged it properly. While filming my pivotal background walk behind the talking heads, I handed out the invitations. Everyone in the office received one, except Jim. I decided that Jim would probably say something sarcastic about the cat party, and Angela Martin was not having it. Sprinkle's birthday was very important to her, and she wasn't going to invite just anyone, especially not a smart aleck. So Jim was out.
When Angela gave me my invitation, I thought it was hilarious. I stuck it to my computer screen, as folks in offices do with random sticky notes. A few days later, I had to shoot a flirty scene between Jim and Pam at the reception desk. After a few takes, Ken came over and said the scene felt a little stiff, and he wanted us to improvise. He reminded us of an improvisation we'd done during the audition process, when they had me stand at the copier and directed John to walk over and start a conversation. John came up to me and said, "What are you copying right now? What is that?" And I responded with a flirty sass, "I'm working. I don't know if you're working, but I have work to do." The dialogue we came up with wasn't very clever, but underneath those boring words, we played out a subtext of two people who were delighted to be standing close and saying anything to each other. Ken suggested we try improvising in a similar way, telling us to talk about any mundane thing while the cameras rolled. And so, when the scene started, I saw the post-it note on my computer. It gave me the idea to say the line, "Are you going to Angela's cat party on Sunday?" I'm not sure why I said Sunday when the post-it clearly says the party is on Tuesday. As Angela predicted, John as Jim shot back, "Yeah, stop, that's ridiculous." And we giggled together. It was a great moment, and it made the cut. But not only that, the exchange planted the seed that Angela was a crazy cat lady.
The writers went on to flesh out the story of Sprinkles for many seasons thereafter.
This is just one example of why our show was so creatively fulfilling. We were constantly given permission to participate in the creation of our characters' backstories, personalities, and lives outside of work. I love that the writers and producers then took those little seeds and grew them into huge, wonderful storylines.
While preparing for the role of Pam, I wrote out a long character history. It was something I had been trained to do in theater school. I am, if anything, a good student. It was important for me to create a detailed personal history for Pam, as I believed it would ground my performance. I spent most of my time thinking about why Pam and Roy had been engaged for so long and not gotten married. There had to be a reason. I made up a backstory that Pam and Roy didn't have enough money for their wedding because Roy spent their wedding money on a pair of jet skis with his brother. I imagined their arguments when Pam found out what Roy had done, Roy's justification that he'd spent separate money, his insistence that she could just use one of the jet skis whenever she wanted, and Pam's resignation and resentment over the whole thing. One day, out of the blue, Greg asked me, "Why do you think Pam and Roy haven't gotten married yet?" My homework was about to pay off. I told Greg the jet ski story, and he lit up. He said, "Oh, we must add this to the show." A week later, it appeared in one of Pam's talking heads. It stayed alive all the way to the cocktails episode in season 3 when Roy and his brother finally sold the jet skis at a loss. This is one of the many reasons why I think Greg Daniels was so amazing. He listened to us. He believed we were the experts on our characters. He wanted our input. And let me tell you, that is a rare thing. In my jobs following The Office, I was surprised to learn how little the writers and producers wanted to hear my thoughts about my character. In those cases, the message that came through was, the creator has a vision, the writers write it, the actors perform it, everyone stay in your lane.
Greg is a very curious person and loves to hear people's stories. He would often ask us questions about our jobs before The Office. Many of us, including Jenna and me, had worked in actual offices. As a temp, I had worked in mailrooms and at reception, been an assistant and an operator, and sat through many human resources meetings. I had a lot of stories to share. I remember rambling on and on about a thermostat war between the call center and the IT department at 1-800-DENTIST, and the time we had a flasher in the women's restroom that resulted in an upgrade to the security system. One year, for extra money, I even volunteered to help with the holiday party. True story. Back then, 1-800-DENTIST had an elaborate company Christmas party, and if you stayed after work to help with the decorating, you could earn extra money. Our office manager was in charge of the party and would get very stressed out about this event. I might have channeled some of her energy for Angela Martin. Greg would jot down notes, and every now and then I'd see something from one of my actual life experiences pop up in a script. It was so exciting to feel like I'd inspired even a small part of the show.
Greg deliberately wanted to change the structure of how a traditional sitcom operated. In addition to everything we've already mentioned, he also had the idea to give some of the writers acting roles on the show. On most sets, the writers and actors are kept separate. In some cases, they barely interact or even know each other. In fact, I know of one television show that is shot in New York while the writers are back in Los Angeles. You can't get more separate than that. Greg was interested in seeing what would happen if he made the two groups more fluid. So, he cast writers BJ Novak, Ryan, Mindy Kaling, Kelly, Paul Lieberstein, Toby, and Mike Schur, Mose, in recurring roles on the show.
The writers were on set with us making observations about how we interacted in real life and how our own personalities might influence the backstories and personalities of our characters. For example, after a long day of filming conference room scenes, the cast became punchy and started goofing around during camera setups. John was entertaining everyone by doing impressions of the cast and crew members. We were all cracking up. Mindy, BJ, and Paul were there too. Next thing you know, there's a storyline where Jim does impressions of his coworkers. First in season 2's drug testing, and then again in product recall in season 3. His Bears Beats Battlestar Galactica impression of Dwight would become a fan favorite.
In another example, Steve Carell played in an actual hockey league and would tell us stories about his team during breaks. Clearly, the writers were listening, because Steve's real-life love of hockey became the inspiration behind both Michael's Birthday and Threat Level Midnight. And from our experience as real office workers, Jenna and I often had ideas. Once when Greg was on set, we pulled him aside to pitch him a plot about Jan hosting a Women in the Workplace seminar for all the women in the office. Greg said, "I love it. What happens next?" And we answered, "We don't know. That's all we got." Greg grabbed BJ and asked us to pitch the idea again. They started jotting down notes and building out our simple idea into a full show. It was so cool to see them work right there in the moment. A few weeks later, we filmed the episode Boys and Girls based on our premise.
We were encouraged to mingle with all the writers, including the ones who weren't performing on the show. The writers' offices were on the second floor of the building next door to where we filmed. We used the exterior of their building to shoot parking lot scenes, and the bottom floor of their building was our lobby and warehouse set. So when you see photos of the exterior of Dunder Mifflin, it was actually the writers who were inside, not the actors. We used a few other parts of their building as well. Remember the stairwell where Dwight pumps himself up with air guitar before his performance review? That stairwell led to the writer's floor. And any time Michael had to look out his window to the parking lot below, those scenes were filmed up in one of the writer's offices that had been dressed to look like Michael's office. Since we were frequently in and out of that building shooting, the actors would often stop by the writer's room for a visit.
I loved visiting the writer's room. In the center of the room was a big conference table where the writers could gather on computers to work. Next to the conference table was a set of sofas. The actors would all pile into that little living room area to hang out. Over the years, that space morphed from a living room to a jam space with a drum kit and keyboard. Then later it was filled with games. Our writers would spend long hours in that room, and they needed creative outlets to keep them going. In the early seasons, there was a very competitive game of Call of Duty between the writers and editors at the office. They would play off and on throughout the day, but on their lunch breaks, it got heated. It came as no surprise when we sat down to read Email Surveillance that the Stanford branch had a competitive Call of Duty game as a storyline.
My favorite thing about the writer's room was the hundreds of note cards taped to the walls. Every evening, the writers would be assigned homework to prepare for the next day. The homework might be something like, come up with 5 storylines for Dwight, office pranks, or obstacles for Jim and Pam. Then, the writing team would pitch their ideas to one another.